Topic number two. For several years now, the nuclear strategy of the United States has been a first-strike strategy. Top Pentagon military strategists are preparing actively for nuclear war with Russia, and they intend for America to strike first. It was not always this way. In fact, America's shift onto a first-strike posture is a new development in American history. This is true even though America's leaders have repeatedly gotten America into war deliberately. The difference is that in the past, America was always dragged into war by at least appearing to be attacked first. That enabled American public opinion to be rallied behind the desired war against the chosen enemy. This approach has always been necessary because most Americans would never support a war that they knew to be America's fault. America's deliberate involvement in falsely defensive wars began as long ago as 1898. On February 15 of that year, the American battleship Maine was resting peacefully at anchor in the harbor of Havana, Cuba. Suddenly, a giant explosion rocked the ship and it blew apart. Some 260 American fighting men aboard the ship lost their lives. To the cry of "Remember the Maine," America went off to war. Afterward, overwhelming evidence was found that the Spaniards had not been responsible for the Maine disaster. Instead, American saboteurs had done the deed in order to bring on the desired war. But by the time those facts began to surface quietly, most Americans were not paying attention. We were just too pleased with ourselves for having crushed Spain and become suddenly a global power. In 1941, America's leaders were spoiling for an even bigger war than America had ever fought before. The reasons had to do with Saudi Arabian oil first and foremost, as I have detailed in the past. The Rockefeller Standard Oil interests had been locked out of the Persian Gulf by British boycott tactics. To cure that problem, the Rockefeller cartel had helped create a threat to Britain in the form of Adolf Hitler. By 1940, the threat was doing its job. The Battle of Britain was underway, and Churchill was finally willing to come to terms. If the United States would intervene and stop Hitler, then after the war, America could have the Saudi oil. To carry out the bargain, FDR and his Rockefeller sponsors had to get America into war somehow. But most Americans did not want war. The only way to change our minds about that was to arrange for America to be attacked. The Germans were in no position to do that, but Japan was. And Japan, Germany, and Italy were inseparably linked through the Tripartite Treaty. So if Japan could be lured into attacking the United States, we would also be at war with Germany automatically. As a bonus, this strategy also promised great new gains for the United States in the Pacific itself. The solution, of course, was Pearl Harbor. When FDR called it a day of infamy, he was right. Roosevelt himself and other top American leaders were guilty of high treason for their role in setting up the Pearl Harbor disaster. I have given many details about this in past audio letters, including numbers 1, 14, 22, and 34. Just in recent months, 4 decades after the fact, pieces of the story have started to leak out and become more widely known. For example, a book was published recently by the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Toland, entitled "Infamy: Pearl Harbor and Its Aftermath." In the book, he documents the fact that FDR and his top military leaders had plenty of advance warning of the attack, and yet no warning was given to the forces at Pearl Harbor. Why? Because FDR wanted the Japanese attack to succeed. The deliberate sacrifice of more than 2,000 American servicemen's lives was just the right medicine to cure America's anti-war attitude. To the cries of "Remember Pearl Harbor," we Americans went off to war to win Saudi oil for the Rockefeller oil cartel. Once again, today's rulers of the United States are trying to get America into another big war. But this time, they dare not allow the enemy, Russia, to strike first, as was done at Pearl Harbor by Japan. America's rulers in 1941 could afford the luxury of throwing away a big chunk of naval power in the Pearl Harbor attack. There was no chance that Japan could go on to actually defeat the United States with its enormous industrial might. But today, it's different. Today, the luxury of time is gone. If the weapons are not ready when war begins, they cannot be built in time to help. And even more importantly, the intended enemy today is far more powerful militarily than the United States. And so, today's top Pentagon strategists are first strike-oriented. In any military campaign, he who strikes the first blow always has the advantage. If the first blow is also a surprise, the advantage is tremendous. Because of all factors of military strategy, surprise is the most important. Just 6 weeks ago, on September 17, the United States came within hours of actually launching a surprise nuclear first strike against Russia. It was the culmination of a hurry-up war plan about which I first began reporting last February in Audio Letter 72. The struggle over this war plan spawned major headlines this year. These included the Falklands War last spring and the sudden forced resignation of Secretary of State Alexander Haig last June. The plan suffered repeated setbacks, and yet it stayed on schedule. It was only during the final 2 weeks or so that the so-called Project Z war plan finally fell apart too far to proceed. The critical events which brought this about were a policy change in Red China, Russian military action in space, and limited public exposure at the last minute. I detailed all this a month ago in Audio Letter 79. The war planners here were frustrated this time, my friends, but they came very close to succeeding. Having come that close, they are convinced they will succeed on the next attempt. And so they already have a new war plan underway. Under this new plan, preliminary preparations and crises are scheduled for about the coming year. Then in late 1983, they presently expect to begin a new final crisis sequence to lead into nuclear war itself in early 1984. The new war plan was set in motion on September 14, 3 days before the abortive end of Project Z. The Israeli plan to murder Lebanese President-elect Bashir Gemayel, which I had made public the previous month, was carried out. That provided the excuse for the Israelis to invade Beirut and quickly arrange for a mass murder of Palestinian civilian refugees. The real payoff of all this was the return of American Marines to Beirut in the beginning of a new and open-ended deployment in Lebanon. In Audio Letters 78 and 79, I reported that the Marines have been sent there to become the focus of a major incident. This will come about under the joint plan of the Bolshevik-controlled United States Pentagon and the Israeli Mossad. The Mossad is to arrange for a number of our Marines to be killed in an incident that will be blamed on the Arabs. This will be used to inflame American public opinion to help lead us into war, including ultimately nuclear war. It is to be a replay of the strategy used in 1898 with the battleship Maine. Already, our psychological conditioning for this planned incident to come is underway. Just 2 days ago, a car bomb exploded close to a Marine position in the south of Beirut. There were no serious injuries this time because they were not meant to be any, but the atmosphere of danger to our leathernecks is being dramatized. At the same time, the government is starting to talk about sending in more Marines, many more, perhaps up to 5,000. And those who are already in Lebanon are gradually fanning out into more and more dangerous duty areas. All of this was set in motion in spite of blunt Russian warnings. This was accomplished by carrying out the Beirut massacre. But the massacre also had a dangerous side effect in the form of worldwide condemnation of Israel. Throughout the latter half of September, the reaction to the Beirut massacre was building fast, especially among the public of Israel and America. Within Israel itself, ways were available to maneuver the protests and keep them from getting out of control. But here in the United States, it was essential to snuff out the reaction to the massacre very quickly. Otherwise, it could have done real damage to the Bolshevik Zionist junta that runs the American and Israeli military machine. People were beginning to question America's blind support for Israel's military power. In order to blot out the Beirut massacre from American minds, a second massacre was perpetrated barely 2 weeks later. It was a Tayanal massacre. The specter of over 1,000 rotting bodies in far-off Beirut were quickly forgotten in the scare over those 7 deaths in Chicago. For most Americans, the Tylenol scare just blanked out everything else. It was an evil masterpiece of psychological trickery. Most of us find it hard to identify with what happened in Beirut, but we can certainly identify with a person taking a headache pill. One story had to do with a lot of foreign people in far-off land. The other had to do with what was portrayed as a threat to each of us personally. As I discussed in my introduction, the Tylenol story stayed on the front page for a solid month, all through October. Now, finally, there is starting to be some renewed emphasis of the Beirut tragedy in the news. We are hearing about eyewitnesses to the slaughter who have contradicted Defense Minister Sharon's claim that the Israelis could not see the killing. But now the psychological danger point is past for the Israelis. It's now old news to most people. No matter what comes out now, it will have almost no chance of interfering with the ongoing war plans. The Reagan Bolsheviks and the Begin Zionists are looking ahead to next year. But in doing so, the Israeli cabinet has suddenly noticed something that makes their blood run cold. It is right there on the Hebrew lunar calendar, which uses Hebrew letters instead of numbers to designate the year. For the next Jewish New Year, my friends, those letters spell the word doom. The Begin cabinet is reacting to this discovery as if the finger of God had appeared and written that word doom on the wall of the Knesset. And no wonder, because they have blood on their hands. The present Jewish New Year began with the Beirut massacre carried out under the authority of the Begin cabinet. But the militant Zionists in Israel are reacting as they always react when confronted with unwelcome facts. They never consider changing their own ways. Instead, their solution is, in their own words, to create new facts. And that is how they are trying to erase that word doom from their calendar. On October 22, a resolution was passed before the Begin cabinet to change the designation of the next new year by rearranging the letters. The American Bolsheviks and their Israeli Zionist allies are starting a lengthy process of recycling their war plans for another try. One factor in this new process is Bolshevik intrigue to try to set off war between India and Pakistan. In Audio Letter 78, I reported that this war was targeted for this month, November 1982, if Project Z did not succeed first. The key to war between India and Pakistan is the disputed territory between them of Kashmir. Kashmir has been held together in relative stability since 1975 by Sheikh Mohammed Abdullah, known as the Line of Kashmir. But about 5 months ago, Abdullah started having a series of heart attacks. The heart attacks, my friends, were not natural. Finally, 2 months ago, on September 8th, he succumbed to one of these attacks. Abdullah's removal from the scene has helped start setting the stage for the Indo-Pakistani war I warned about in August. But the Russians know what is afoot, and they are advising India's leader Indira Gandhi to defuse the situation. As a result, she invited Pakistan's General Zia to New Delhi for talks on improving relations. Zia arrived there 2 days ago, met with Mrs. Gandhi, and left a group of diplomats to talk further. Whether all this will prevent the war is an open question, but at least it should help slow down the Bolshevik intrigues. The process of recycling for another war try involves many aspects of the total military picture. For one thing, the Bolshevik Pentagon war planners hope to rebuild some semblance of their secret weapons reserves. I first reported on their existence and role in the intended nuclear war in Audio Letter 73. These were the real reason for the Southern Hemisphere War last spring, of which the Falklands War was only the visible part. I can now report that the Bolshevik-controlled secret naval facilities were not destroyed, even though they were put out of action. A crash program is now underway to repair the damage, both at South Georgia Island and at the two southern New Zealand sites. As I reported in Audio Letter 74, a portion of the Bolshevik Stealth Navy escaped altogether from the hostilities. Another aspect of the Pentagon's recycling process has to do with America's newly deployed secret stealth planes, called Phantom War Planes. These have yet to be tested in combat, but they are believed to be capable of successfully attacking Russia. But due to the sudden change in China's policies in early September, the crucial Sinkiang Province launch area is presently unavailable. Should it still be unavailable a year from now, the Pentagon is determined to have the next best backup site ready to go. That backup site, my friends, is none other than Kashmir, the disputed area between India and Pakistan. It is far inferior to Sinkiang Province, China, being nearly twice as far away from Russia's Cosmosphere bases. But it is still better than anything else. So don't be surprised if Pakistan goes ahead and attacks India to seize Kashmir within the next year. Talks or no talks. And then there is the space shuttle. As I've detailed in past tapes, the space shuttle is the indispensable key to the Pentagon's plans to use space for the coming nuclear war. All four space shuttle missions up to now have been military missions, described to the public as test flights. Now Space Shuttle Launch Number 5 is about to take place, scheduled for November 11, just a few days from now. Now the alleged test schedule has been used up. In order to preserve appearances, there is no choice but to start following through now with some launches of civilian payloads. That is what Space Shuttle 5, now on the pad at Cape Canaveral, will be doing. For the first time, there will be no military payload on this shuttle. For that reason, on this flight, we will probably get to see what is actually happening during the mission. Space Shuttle 5 will be a first in other ways, too. The first four flights used a skeleton crew of only two astronauts. This time, there are four: Allen, Brand, Overmeyer, and Lenore, three of whom are civilians. But the most important first for Space Shuttle 5 will be one that is totally unsuspected by the public. My friends, this will be the first mission to use just one shuttle from start to finish. The first four missions used the two-shuttle stratagem, which I first made public in Audio Letter 62. Each time we watched a shuttle with the name Columbia on the side take off from Florida. Once in orbit, the plan called for the astronauts to carry out their military mission while the public was shown falsified space movies about the flight. Then the two-man crew was to return to Earth, not aboard the shuttle itself, but aboard a two-man re-entry capsule. The shuttle itself, if possible, was to return to Earth unmanned, landing by computer control in Western Australia. Finally, back on Earth, the two astronauts boarded a different shuttle with the name Columbia on the side. It was boosted to high speed and then glided to Earth for the public to watch. But this time, it will be different. This time, it is a non-military mission, and there are four astronauts, too many to fit into a re-entry capsule. The shuttle which takes off from Florida will have to land in California 5 days later. The NASA military shuttle managers believe there will be no trouble from Russia on this flight. It is purely non-military, and this shuttle is unarmed. But there is still one major worry. That worry, my friends, is just this. Will the thermal tiles really work? No one knows, because no space shuttle has ever re-entered from orbital velocity before. All four of the shuttles we have watched blast off from Florida have been destroyed in space by Russian space weapons before they could return to Earth. So Space Shuttle 5 will actually make the first test of the tiles. NASA believes that the tiles will hold. If they do, the landing at Edwards Air Force Base on November 16 will look just like the four fake landings we have seen up to now. If the tiles do not work, four astronauts may pay with their lives for the NASA deception up to now. Even so, having falsified four allegedly successful landings, NASA will find a way to explain it away if Space Shuttle 5 should end in disaster, because a year from now, the Space Shuttle will be needed to start preparing for war once again. Topic number 3. On Wednesday, October 27, the man known as President Leonid Brezhnev delivered a speech of major importance in Moscow. The speech came on the heels of a surprise conference of all Warsaw Pact foreign ministers convened in Moscow just 5 days earlier. The importance of the Brezhnev speech was emphasized in every way possible. Brezhnev was flanked on the podium by his five senior colleagues in the Politburo, and his audience of more than 500 consisted of the entire upper crust of the giant Soviet military establishment. Present were all top defense ministry officials, all Soviet marshals, the commanders of all the Russian military services, all regional Soviet commanders, the commanders of Soviet forces abroad, and the top echelon of the policy directorate of the armed forces. The Brezhnev speech was directed first and foremost to the military and to the Russian technological establishment which backs them up, but it was also directed to the entire Soviet public and was broadcast in its entirety over nationwide television. In his speech, Brezhnev accused the United States of trying to bring about nuclear war. He said that America's leaders have, quote, raised the intensity of their military preparations to an unprecedented level. And he accused the so-called Reagan administration of, and I quote again, an aggressive policy which is threatening to push the world into the flames of nuclear war, unquote. My friends, government and major media spokesmen always try to lead us Americans to discount all accusations like that by Russian leaders. But those harsh words of October 27 in Moscow were not just rhetoric. Far from it. Brezhnev was referring to the Pentagon's Project Z nuclear strike plan, which came within hours of execution just 6 weeks ago. Brezhnev even alluded to the superweapon aspect of the present war threat. America's radically new Phantom warplanes are designed to nullify Russia's ability to stave off an attack with her beam weapons. Brezhnev assessed the situation in the words, "Competition in military technology has sharply intensified, often acquiring a fundamentally new character," unquote. And he exhorted Russia's technologists to find the solutions to the threat. The Brezhnev speech was most notable for the change of policy which it revealed. For 18 years now, the Brezhnev image has been associated with détente. But in this speech, all that was virtually abandoned, devalued. Aside from one brief passing reference, no hope was held out for reviving détente with America's rulers. Instead, the whole thrust of the speech was that the Russian people must prepare militarily for the days ahead. It was not a saber-rattling speech directed at America. It was a call to arms directed to his own people. My friends, the significance of this major change in stated policy can hardly be overstated. It reflects two very important developments. One of the developments that led to the Brezhnev speech is the Kremlin's assessment of the inevitability of nuclear war one. As I have reported on past occasions, Russia's new anti-Bolshevik rulers know their old Bolshevik enemies only too well. Having ousted the Bolsheviks from control of Russia, the new Kremlin now is confronted by a Bolshevik-controlled American military. The Russians are convinced that the Bolsheviks will just keep trying to set off nuclear war until they finally succeed. And Project Z was such a close call in September that the Russians are not optimistic that they can stop the next attempt. The second development that led to the Brezhnev speech of October 27 is that a changing of the guard is underway in the Kremlin. It's not a power struggle in the old Bolshevik sense of intrigue and infighting. Instead, it's an orderly succession among a tightly knit group of men who are convinced that Russia must prepare for action. And they want to take advantage of the law right now while the Bolsheviks here regroup in the wake of the Project Z failure in September. The Russian people are being prepared for the end of the Brezhnev era in the very near future. For the very first time ever, preparations are underway for a Soviet leader to peacefully and voluntarily retire with honors. It will be just one more step in the new Kremlin's gradual step-by-step program of changing the rules of life in Russia. In one sense, the so-called Brezhnev retirement will only be a ceremonial fiction. The real Brezhnev died of complications from Russian flu on January 7, 1978. I first reported his incapacitation and replacement by a ceremonial double in Audio Letter 30. Later in Audio Letter 33, I was able to report the date of his death. Since that time, several doubles have been employed to maintain the Brezhnev image until the time was ripe for change. That time, my friends, has now arrived. During the interim since the real Brezhnev's death, a succession of several men have held the reins of top power in Russia. First, it was Defense Minister Ustinov, leader of the White Doves. Then it was the head of the Soviet Navy, Admiral Gorshkov. Next, power was shared among several men. But none of these men could truly fill the shoes of the departed Brezhnev, and the search for more effective leadership has continued. Now, my friends, that search is at an end. The new ruler of Russia is already taking the reins of power right now. It may be some time yet before his true role becomes publicly visible, but his mark is already being stamped on Russian policies. It was he, more than anyone else, who was the architect of the startling Brezhnev speech, so-called, of October 27. Russia's new top ruler spent 15 years as head of Russia's Worldwide Intelligence Service, the KGB. When he took charge in 1967, his task was to transform the KGB by rooting out all Bolshevik power over it. His success in doing so helped set the stage for the final overthrow of the Bolsheviks from Kremlin power in 1976 and 1977. Now he has been chosen to become the top leader of the Soviet Union. The name of Russia's new leader is Yuri Andropov. Right now, that name may be unfamiliar to you, but I urge you to start watching for it in the news. Directly or indirectly, we will be hearing more and more from Andropov from this time forward. Now it's time for my last-minute summary. In this audio letter, I've tried to give you some perspective on the probable direction of events over the next year or so. The Bolsheviks here failed to set off their nuclear war plan in September, so now they are recycling for another try in a year or so. Meanwhile, they are turning inward to tighten their grip on America itself through economic means. At the same time, the Russians, too, are taking advantage of this breather for a changing of the guard in the Kremlin. They are preparing for action with a new, strong leader at the helm. Here in America, the destruction of our currency is continuing, with the $100 bill now targeted for special attack. By this economic route, the civilization of America itself is being undermined. Over the course of generations, we Americans have been lured to worship the so-called almighty dollar. So we have come under the spell of those who have made the dollar corrupt as a tool of power. In the last analysis, the most basic cause of our deepening economic crisis is something our Lord Jesus Christ tried to warn us about long ago. He said, "We cannot serve two masters, both God and mammon. Either we will love one or we will cling to the other." Today, America as a whole is clinging to mammon and forgetting God. If that does not change, my friends, the ages ahead will be dark indeed. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.